House Workforce Development Finance Committee will come to order. Representative Hemmings and Yeager, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from March 31st?
I like to sit on these.
Maybe.
Okay.
You can pick up.
Any corrections needed? How about those in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Today we have House File 2, paid family leave program established. And so Representative Richardson, I will move that the House File 2 be referred to a taxes committee. And before we get to amendments and discussion, I'd like to ask our nonpartisan staff from House Fiscal to give us a brief walkthrough of the fiscal note for House File 2. So, Ms. Ng.
Mr. Chair, members, Ashley Ng, House Fiscal. I'm looking at the fiscal note for House File 2, the 3A version. Starting at the front page, the agencies impacted by this bill include administrative hearings, commerce, employment and economic development, human services, labor and industry, the legislature, the Met Council, Minnesota Management and Budget, Minnesota State, Secretary of State, Supreme Court, and the University of Minnesota. Looking at the bold chart on page 2, the total general fund impact in fiscal year 24 is $1,704,025,000. In fiscal year 25 is $1,843,000. In fiscal year 26, it's $23 million. And in fiscal year 27, is $23,968,000. The paid family leave account has a revenue of $1,649,061,000. Has an impact of $71 million in fiscal year 25, $732,000. And then the revenue in fiscal year 26 of $210,637,000. And in fiscal year 27, a revenue of $226,760,000. The all other funds impact is $143,000 in fiscal year 25. And $11,020,000 in fiscal year 26 and $11,020,000 in fiscal year 27. Looking at the FTEs, the bottom chart on that page, total at the bottom is 34.5 in fiscal year 24, 237.22 in fiscal year 25, 417.43 in fiscal year 26, and 420.43 in fiscal year 27. There was a spreadsheet included in your packets which details the expenditures for each agency, but I will not review that unless there are questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ng, and welcome to committee. Chair Richardson, would you like to do a brief statement on your bill before we go move on to amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to staff for also walking through the fiscal note as well. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to make some brief opening remarks. I just want to take a moment to lift up the incredible amount of work that continues to happen around this bill, engaging groups representing employers, business owners, the insurance industry, state agencies, city and county considerations, social service organizations, and families. This bill is a reflection of many voices, and as we work to make it better for employers, including those interested in offering a private plan, we're also working to ensure that there are strong protections for workers as well. The United States is the only country without a paid family leave policy among high-wealth nations. The rest of the world, including low-income countries, offer paid leave. We are also an outlier when it comes to paid medical leave. Research consistently shows across race, gender, economic status, age, political affiliation, there is support for a comprehensive paid family and medical leave program. Nationally, 70% of small businesses support a publicly administered paid leave program, and paid leave programs are also incredibly popular across party lines. 84% of voters support paid family leave programs. Research also shows that there's a significant cost of inaction as well. What is ultimately at the heart of this bill is the recognition of universal humanity, a recognition that at some point we or our loved ones are going to need time to bond, to heal, recover, or navigate providing care for a loved one with a serious health condition. While we all face these crossroads, we know this current system design has created an inequitable and uneven safety net. The ability to care for yourself or your loved ones is a basic human need that should not be denied because of where you work, the size of your employer, the color of your skin, your gender, who you love, or your zip code. Our current system design reinforces the notion that only some are worthy of care, worthy of rest to recover, our time to care for themselves or their families. This bill will reject that harmful narrative and begin to build a long overdue, more inclusive safety net. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
See that we have three amendments for today. The first amendment is the 837 from Lee Baker. Lee Baker would like to move and explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to pull that up quick. Thank you. I forgot those. A37. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 837 amendment recognizes businesses with fewer employees. I know we've had this conversation quite a bit of the time. What we're trying to get to here, I want to make sure I get the right one, though. Is this right? One moment, Mr. Chair. This one here. Thank you. Okay, yep. All right. So the A37 is one where we want to recognize the 50 employees that opt out of the, we wanted to get them opt out of the paid family leave program. If their employer opts out, however, an employee opt out to the into the program has the same situations as an independent contractor. This came up a couple days ago in Commerce, and actually I think Representative Liebling was the one who asked the good question. If we were to ever consider having these small employers exempted, the question from Liebling was, well, what about those employees that didn't have that option to join in? What this amendment does is allows that individual employee who still wants to be part of this to be treated like an independent contractor, or the language that's already part of this bill, to allow that to happen. One of the main things that's missing from this bill, Chair Richardson, is just that recognition, and you and I have talked about this before, is that recognition of identifying a small business, because this one-size-fits-all is where we're kind of really running into some major trouble with this. So, Mr. Chair, I guess I'll ask the author to maybe consider this amendment to then allow us to find that sweet spot so that you can say if the employer can't do it for many reasons, we can recognize a level similar to our federal folks have done with FMLA, but also can we then make sure that nobody is turned away if they want to be part of your this program? So I would hope that you could look at this amendment. And again, this was kind of drafted after some comments by the majority in recent hearings for this purpose. I think that was a very good question that Liebling had, Mr. Chair.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for the discussion and for the amendment as well. You know, one thing that I do just want to start with, and I think it's important that we have on the record, employee size is not necessarily going to be a proxy for revenues. And so I think we should keep that in mind as we're having this discussion. And just a reminder in terms of the way that House File 2 has been designed and built, it's been designed mirroring successful programs that are in other states. This would be a new and novel approach. And I think that there are some questions that would come with taking a approach like this. I would have questions about how it would impact the administrative burden to have this move from the employer down to the employee level. And I think that that would be an important sort of conversation to understand what comes with that complexity and that administrative burden, particularly for the departments who would be required to administer this. And there's also just sort of this question about how do we keep track of businesses that would be at that threshold of 50, because recognizing that that could shift pretty frequently for entities that are around that size, and what happens if one starts above 50 or shrinks below, and just thinking about the complexity that would come from employees trying to understand whether they would be covered, and how do we also avoid people sort of opting in when they need the program and then going away. So I think there are some good questions that are raised here, but I think that it would need more conversation and discussion to understand exactly what that would look like, and recognizing that there's also sort of this responsibility for submitting payroll data and pay premiums. Those are things that employers are used to doing with our UI system, but this would be new for this to be on the employee level. So with that, I would recommend a no vote.
Mr. Chair, you're right. It's complicated, and it doesn't need to get much more complicated than it is, because you've already recognized that independent contractors, Representative Richardson, are also have a way to opt in. To manage and understand the level and number of employees in a company, that happens actually every quarter with Deed, when we report our total payroll and our payroll earnings with our quarterly payroll reports. There is a system already in place to sort of monitor that. There is an enormous amount of information and data from Deed currently, and I think that what we need to look at is, if this is going to be successful, we need to find ways to not have companies push back hard because they didn't have any choices in the matter. We've got to find ways to encourage them to come in better. And having this option for the employee to jump in so that they can get the benefits that they'd like to do, we need to build this system so that it isn't complicated, because we already have this information. We're going to have a lot of auditing questions probably today about how are we going to watch certain things happening? How are we going to make sure that employers are doing what they're supposed to be doing, but also employees, to make sure they're not hurting the system by working outside of that period. During that period, we've got a lot of things that we want to ask about. But again, we're trying to find ways to find a system that is unique. Like you said, this is unique to the system that you've seen around the country. But we're building something here that we need to build in some flexibility as well. Again, this is important things to talk about. I wish you would take it, or at least offer to make sure that we continue to work on this, because this important issue of identifying a small business somehow, we have to find a way to do that. Other states found a way. Whether it's 10 employees, 20 employees, they found a way to carve them out. Others have found ways to carve out seasonal employees. Others are doing it. We should be able to do it as well. So, Mr. Chair, I think I want to make sure that we do this, and I want to ask for a roll call on this, but I want to make sure that we allow this discussion to continue. I'm hoping that you might allow it just to continue to work on this, Representative Richardson, or at least to commit that we'll do this. But I felt that this is an important part of really honing in on a small business and how challenging this will be, but it still gives this option to those employees who want to have that coverage. So I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for the comments as well. And, you know, this bill has continued to be modified and changed as it moves through the process. We have a number of other committee stops as well, and I'm committed to continuing to work together on this and with an eye towards ensuring that there is the most even safety net that is available to ensure that all workers have the ability to care for themselves and others when needed.
Representative Senator Muir.
Thank you, and my apologies because I entered the conversation a bit late, but I just wanted to ask kind of a clarifying question about something that I just heard Lead Baker say, which was, you know, that we want to leave it up. I think I heard you to say we want to leave it up for, you know, for the employee to have the option to have it. And I guess when I'm reading this, I'm seeing that the employer has the option, but the employee doesn't, right? The employer would be the one making the decision about whether the company or the organization would be opting in versus the employee. And I guess that's where I see a difference between a contractor, where I'm an independent contractor, I can make the decision for myself about whether I opt in. But if I'm an employee, it's and I'm a company with less than 50 people, then it's all up to my employer to make that decision. And I do think that there's a distinction there that's important around kind of what leverage or what power does the employee have in that situation to, because if the employer opts out of it, you can't elect to participate in this benefit, as I'm understanding it from the amendment that you've written.
Mr. Chair.
Lead Baker.
Thank you. The intent of if you're reading it that way, that's not the intent. The intent here is to say, if the employer says no, the employee can opt in. Now, I think what we could do in this language is maybe continue to work on this and have it so that the employer is required to collect the fees or a payroll fee if they want to be participating in this. And again, I don't have the amendment in front of me. Is this it right here? So what it is supposed to be doing here is allowing the individual employee to opt in if the employer has elected not to provide paid family leave coverage, as mentioned on 1.9 on the amendment, A37. So again, the employer should be involved probably to help collect the dollars so that it's a more easy flow. But it's something that is important to recognize that not all employers, if we found a sweet spot where that small employer is identified, can literally do this. And so, again, not to belabor it, but I hope that we can find a way to start looking at making sure that every employee in the state, whether their employer can participate or not, has the ability to access this.
Further discussion. Clerk will take the roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, roll call voting on amendment amendment 37 will now commence. Representatives, please state aye, nay, or abstain when called upon. Let's go with Chair Zhang.
No.
Representative Brand.
Nay.
Lead Baker.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
No.
Representative Harder.
Aye.
Representative Hemmingsen-Yeager.
No.
Representative Ryer.
No.
Representative Sensormura.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Zeleznikar.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, I report to you. We have 4 ayes and 7 nays.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Next is the 838 from Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Zhang. I move the amendment A38, and I do request a roll call, please.
Roll call has been requested.
Thank you, Chair.
Your amendment.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Richardson, so my amendment is a fairly, I want to say, a simple one. So there was a recent amendment in Commerce which permits employee right to reinstatement requirements to be waived for employees working in the construction industry, as we know, depend upon when they're gone and their contracts coming in, that they will still have their same positions. However, construction isn't the only industry that faces challenges when employees are on leave for extended periods of time. And this is can be very challenging for our small businesses. So my amendment would offer businesses with less than 50 employees the same type of flexibility. Thank you.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Harder, for the for offering the amendments and the background on that. And I think, you know, just to continue to lift up the challenges within our system right now and the way that it is designed, because it is an uneven safety net, the folks that are tending to be left behind in terms of having access to paid family and medical leave include women, low-wage workers, and also Black, Indigenous, and other people of color. And oftentimes, these are the individuals that are in most need of job protections. With our current system design, the way it works is that the individuals that probably could most likely float a leave without paid family leave have access to that protection, and the individuals who are living paycheck to paycheck don't have that. So I think it's important that we continue to work to build a much more even safety net. And in terms of the addition of the amendment and commerce, I do just want to clarify that the waiver would allow the unions and the employer to address job protections through the collective bargaining process. And if there's sort of more technical questions around that, Melissa Heising is here if there are some additional questions that are related to that.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Zhang. I understand that between the unions and the employers and their protection. I'm just most concerned with the small businesses and the impact. And I just feel that they deserve some of the same types of flexibility. And that we should really be looking at that for our smallest businesses that we have. In my district that I serve, so many of the businesses that I have are small business, 1, 2, maybe 10 people. And I'm just looking for ways to help them manage this particular bill if it becomes law. So I would appreciate you take it under advisement or whatever the case might be, that we work on that to have some protections for our small businesses so they can continue to thrive and be vibrant in this state. Thank you.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Harder. And I would just also include that within the bill there are subsidies and benefits that can be available for employers with under 50 employees. So there is help that is currently drafted within the bill, and happy to continue conversations around that if there are ways to build upon what's in the bill currently that would relate to those with employers with under 50 employees.
Lead Baker.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Harder, for bringing this to us. And again, I think this is our attempt, Representative Richardson, to knock on the door to recognize exceptions to small employers. We are trying to understand how will it work if, and maybe your testifier can answer this if that's what this is here as a question, is if, again, my company, a seasonality company of hotels, we're busier in the summer, slower in the fall and the winter. I have more hours to offer people, and if an employee of mine left my employment for a leave and they left at a peak season or a higher season and they come back under that rule and I don't have the business any longer to fulfill that, either what is my promise to them? Do they require, because they were making maybe for 2 months before they left, they were making full-time hours. But maybe they, and then again, they've usually worked a part-time basis in the other season. What do they return to? Again, the majority made an exception for unions, contractors, to this bill on returning to work. For union members, for building trades, I get it. It's unique. They have They have reasons to want that. But I also want to understand, why can't this also apply to seasonal businesses and small businesses like I've just kind of described? That's where I'm looking for that help.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for the question as well. And so, you know, in terms of this, I mean, what we're really getting to is job protections and understanding that if there is a job that is lasting a few weeks, and also understanding that there's an actual negotiation process that is going on between the labor unions and their employers. And so this is sort of a give and take piece of being able to address that through collective bargaining within a contract. You know, there are nuances when there isn't sort of that give and take going on. I think that we can, like I said, continue to have conversations about this. I know that there's a different approach that is being taken to the bill within the Senate. So I know that there's going to be ongoing conversations around what this looks like, thinking about seasonality for various employers as well.
Mr. Chair.
Lead Baker.
Thank you. And again, you're right. There's got to be give and take. You've recognized a give in the Commerce Committee when it came to the recognizing unions and their uniquenesses. We're sort of asking you, and I think as a collaborative representative who's carrying a massive insurance bill, you should, I think, take as many ideas as you can like this to conference, to take it to those conversations, so we out of the House don't look like we paid no attention to small business, that we didn't recognize anything. And the only groups that were recognized were the folks in the buildings trades. And so that it looks like you're not bringing ideas to this, because we know we have a lot more stops. We understand we're going to taxes, and then we're going to go to ways, and then back on the floor. And we have a lot of work left to do. And I hope that we can be a part of this. But these are the times, I think, Representative Richardson, that we can try to continue to bring these ideas to the conference committee in a written form, in an organized way, so we can make them better as it goes further. But to see give and take and the exceptions that we're making for certain groups and not for other groups that are important to rural Minnesota especially is alarming, and that's where I think this amendment is really reasonable, and I hope that you would consider that.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, and I want to state again that this bill has been changing, and we have been taking into account comments and concerns from a myriad of different stakeholders, those representing employers, the insurance industry, business owners, agencies, city and county considerations, and social service organizations as well. And I also think that it's important that we make a distinction between the difference of bargaining, having the ability to bargain for a contract, versus being in a situation of where your employer can make a decision that you don't have the ability to bargain around. I think those are two distinct situations there. But as I said before, this will clearly be a subject within the conference committee based upon the way that the language is moving across the different bodies.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Richardson, thank you for carrying this bill. It has been through a lot of committees. I had the pleasure and honor of presenting the bill in Commerce in the last committee stop, and that was where we put on a huge amendment that took into account many of the statements and concerns, and tried to address many of the concerns by tons of the stakeholders that we've been engaging with on this bill. So I just keep hearing the implication that there's not this give and take in this conversation, and that we're not modifying the bill as we move forward. And I just want to say for the record, that's not true. That is happening, and it will continue to happen as we make stops in the next committee before it reaches the floor, and it will continue on that debate on the floor, and will also continue as we get to conference committee. And there's also much modification happening on the Senate side as well that will bring things into the conference committee. One of my concerns about this amendment is that not only does it create a disproportionality between the employer and the employees in terms of the give and take. But it also takes away the ability of the employee if the employer decides to say, hey, if you're going to take this leave, you're not coming back. Right? Because what I'm understanding is that this bill takes away the ability for there to be a claim for retaliation. Is that correct? Now I'm asking that question. Is that correct? Am I reading that right?
Representative Harder?
No. I don't think so. No, that's not. No.
That's not correct?
That's not how I interpret it.
I had staff to clarify that.
Mr. Chair and members, so I think this amendment is targeted at the reinstatement provisions, and so that there would be a similar ability to not apply those to businesses with 50 or fewer employees. I don't think it directly speaks to retaliation.
Representative Fager.
Thank you. That's great. Thanks for that clarity and my mistake for misstating that. But what I would like to add before I close is that I don't think the number of employees that an employer has should make a determination on what type of worker rights protections that those employees have. A big part, the reason we have this bill is to keep employees connected to their to the workforce and to that employer if they have to take advantage of this safety net, and I think we should keep that in mind. That is what we're trying to do here. So I think we should keep that in mind. And thank you again, Chair Richardson, for carrying the bill.
Further discussion to the amendment. Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Roll call voting on HF 2 Amendment 38 will now commence. Chair Zhang?
No.
Representative Brand?
No.
Lead Baker?
Yes.
Representative Frazier?
No.
Representative Harder?
Yes.
Representative Hemingsing-Yeager?
No.
Representative Ryer?
No.
Representative Sensimura?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Zalesnikar?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I report to you we have 6 nays and 4 ayes.
Motion does not prevail. The 838 is not adopted. Next is the 839 from Representative Nelson to your amendment, and if you want to move it. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to move the 839 amendment, and this will just simply put a cap on the premium at 1% of taxable wages. I think right now it's 0.7% in the bill, and so we'll just cap that at 1%, and so it would still give a fair amount of leeway and flexibility in the amount that needs to be collected to keep the account solvent, and at the same time it would give some surety to our job providers on what they could expect to pay. So I would hope this could be a friendly amendment and hope that it could be adopted.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so one of the amendments that went on in Commerce clarifies that we will be doing an actuarial study to ensure that there's more information around program costs. The way that the bill was built out was using modeling from the U.S. Department of Labor in conjunction with DEED, and there was also a report from the University of Minnesota as well. And so I think it's going to be important that we take a moment here, and also recognizing that there is a Senate the Senate has put a cap on the bill. And so, again, this is something that is clearly going to be on the table for negotiation and conference committee. I believe that the Senate put a 1.2% annual cap on. And so looking forward to continuing to work with members to figure out the best approach, and would ask for a no vote at this time.
Representative Nelson.
I thank you for Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson. I think it's thankful to talk about this, and I would hope that maybe we could put this in and have some negotiation between the House and the Senate, have some negotiation there. And I'm glad to hear on the actuarials of the study that's going to be required with that. And because these are based off of assumptions, but at the same time, we need to know where actuarials are and, have a better understanding of where this is. And I guess that was my point of the amendment, was really trying to get a solid ground for what our, job providers are planning to pay on this. And I think with that, I would like to ask for a roll call on this vote.
Roll call has been requested. Lead Baker.
Mr. Chair, thanks. I think what I'm hearing, a bit of a tone with our majority members, is that the Senate is writing a different bill than we are, and it's a bill that we should be paying attention to, and we do. We know there's a 1.2 cap right now in the Senate, but we need to come out of the House with a cap. I think what we need to do here, members, is to recognize that after we pass this bill and sign into law, it's likely going to happen before the actuary comes out, which is backwards. Why would we ever sign and sign off on a bill before the actuary that has been agreed to, which was one of the best things you allowed in the bill, Representative Richardson? Thank you for that. But it's coming after we are done with our work here. So what Representative Nelson is asking for is, hey, let's recognize we ought to have a ceiling for now, knowing that we come back and change it if something shows us to change it. And I think what we are saying then to our business owners of all sizes is that we recognize we have to have some guardrails on this, so that when it comes out of the House position, it doesn't show that we have had no guardrails, no limits, that we're recognizing, I think, a 30% increase of what you're suggesting from what it is today, to say this is a reasonable cap, take it to conference, find that right number. But our position might be something. But to go in with nothing on a cap, Representative Richardson, I think is sending the wrong message that the House cares about some assurances that it shouldn't go above this. And I think it's just good policy to do this. I think it's a good one to take to conference. And I really hope that members see this, because of the actuary and when we're going to get it, makes sense to do this today.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to clarify for the record that there was extensive modeling that was done to get to this point, again, lifting up the modeling based on the U.S. Department of Labor and also the work with the University of Minnesota as well. So I want to lift up that this is, I guess, what we would refer to here as a belt and suspenders approach from the additional modeling that would be done with an actuarial study.
Further discussion? Seeing none, clerk will take the roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Roll call voting on HF2 Amendment 39 will now commence. Chair Zhang.
No.
Vice Chair Brand.
No.
Lead Baker.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
No.
Representative Harder.
Aye.
Representative Hemingston-Yeager.
No.
Representative Ryer.
No.
Representative Sensenmura. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, I report to you we have 6 nays and 4 ayes.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Okay, now we are on to the bill. Discussions on the bill. Lee Baker.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and again for allowing us, Representative Richardson, to really hone in on the fiscal aspects of this bill today. So thank you for that. I think a lot of my questions might be asked to our friends at Deed, so maybe Mr. Rowe would like to make his way down. I think they did much of the modeling and much of the understanding. So the fiscal note, for those of you that are watching online and are kind of wondering about how this all works, we have been waiting for a fiscal note for some time. It is a very complex bill. It is one that the state of Minnesota is writing a brand new insurance plan that creates a paid family and medical leave act. It is very encompassing, very expansive. It covers every single employer, nonprofit, everybody in the state. So there's a number of questions that we have, and I know we've got a hard stop at noon, Mr. Chair. And again, I appreciate the ability today to ask some questions, and I've got a number of them up front for Mr. Rowe, if that's okay. I guess maybe my first question to Deed, thank you for being here, and I know you got to introduce yourself and stuff, but Mr. Rowe, if you could explain to us the changes in your modeling from the older version to the newer version. For members that saw, we had a rate increase when this bill came out this year than what was different from last sessions, and just the modeling concept. I know you can't get into the weeds. I don't want you to go for an hour, but just help us understand. A lot of things change right away, like, you know, the time leaves and the models that you use. So if I could just ask for that, Mr. Rowe.
Welcome to committee, Commissioner Rowe. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Evan Rowe. I'm Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Services and Operations at the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. Mr. Chair and Lead Baker, I want to make sure that I imagine there will be a lot of questions, kind of a lot to get into, but I want to make sure I can answer as comprehensively as possible. So, I think as far as the modeling approach, and I just want to make sure first, when you're speaking about the previous version, are you speaking about versions that were submitted in fiscal notes in prior legislative sessions, or differences between the House file fiscal note and the Senate file fiscal note?
The first version there, from the older session versions, maybe it was the University of Minnesota versus what we have today with the federal thing. That's what I want to understand.
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Lee Baker. So, since that fiscal note and previous versions were created, which predated my time at the agency, to be totally honest, there's been a fair amount of work that's been done by the United States Department of Labor to update the underlying models, to kind of back test them, to update them with more up to date data based on experiences from other states, also to make it more usable by agencies such as ours to be able to run the modeling ourselves. So previously the model was developed by a group of researchers, including I think from a group called Impact International, and over time, that work has been the model has moved to the United States Department of Labor, which supports the model, provides updates, provides updates around it, and is making sure that it is again up to date with the latest data and information.
Okay. Lee Baker,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I next question again, a few more as we kind of continue just down that line, and so again for folks that have heard. We're seeding the program with $1.7 billion, I think, of kind of a startup fund, if you will. And then there's in appropriations of $668 million the targets from the governor's office. Will you help us understand, Mr. Rowe, the difference of what the 668 means to what the 1.7 means as this program kind of moves along?
Mr. Rowe.
Chair Zhang, Lead Baker, I will defer to the author on the $1.7 billion figure, since that was part of the legislation as submitted. As far as the appropriation recommended in the governor's budget, that's viewed as representing sufficient capital to provide a very stable seed reserve for the fund overall, as well as to fund the initial implementation costs of the bill, such that there would be a budgetary reserve for the fund, as well as being able to support the rollout of the program. But on the $1.7 billion question, I would defer to the author on that.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the $1.7 billion that was in this year's bill was also in the bill last year as well. And it was really designed to be seed money to shore up the fund from the beginning.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Lead Baker.
Thank you. Some of the real important numbers that I wasn't able to find in the fiscal note of the 73 pages or so are what we maybe were used to in the prior version. So what I'm going to ask you now, probably Mr. Rowe, is can you tell us in this modeling, what is the average number of weeks that it's assumed a user will take in the first year of the program?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Lead Baker. So I think one of the changes between the previous version of the model that was provided or that was used to develop the fiscal note here and the current version that the United States Department of Labor provides is that there isn't it does not actually provide a summary output of the number of weeks. What is used as sort of the overall in terms of the overall assumptions are the usage rates, which you'll see in the table on page, I think it's 11 of the fiscal note. But sorry, it doesn't actually have an output for the average number of weeks, and I think that's primarily because I think that's my sense is that's primarily just when the U.S. DOL kind of made updates around the model, that was a feature that did not kind of go through.
So, Ms. Baker. Thank you. So, what I'm understanding is this. This new formula here, you are taking. Maybe you need to help me understand this a little bit more deeply. What I'm used to is understanding, like we do with unemployment insurance. Okay, we average our weeks, we average our pay, we average how many times they have 13 weeks off. Blah blah blah. Can you help us with this formula? Can you help us kind of put it back into a formula that we kind of understand? Can you get it close for us to help us with this?
Commissioner Rowe.
Chair Zhang, Lead Baker. So maybe it would help if I just kind of walk through how the modeling software works.
Great.
and sort of at a high level, and but my apologies if I get too far into the weeds here. This is all written out on page I think 10 of the HF2 fiscal note. Essentially, the way the model works is it's an open source simulation tool that the phrase that they use is it's micro simulation. So it's taking a few different data sources. The key ones are the U.S. Census American Community Survey public use micro data sample. It's using FMLA data from the U.S. Department of Labor. That's employee survey data, and then it's using the assumptions that are noted in the fiscal note to essentially run a series of simulations on worker behavior and the likelihood that each worker would take leave, and then that ties out to the claims value and to a dollar value. So essentially, it's the American Community Survey public use micro data sample allows you to individually sort of model the likelihood that somebody would take family leave or medical leave or parental leave. And then it essentially assigns a likelihood that they would take that leave, and then it basically sums up all those categories to get you to the table on page 11, which kind of gets you to own health, number of estimated beneficiaries, and the dollar value of those estimated benefits.
Lead Baker.
So what I'm also trying to understand here is with that modeling. that's based on some federal, you know, inputs. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that they're able to offer that assistance, but what the FMLA offers or provides is a kind of a different product than what we're offering here in Minnesota. They are not recognizing employers of under 50. And so is that baked into this? And I'm trying to understand then, how do we get to the $1.1 billion dollars of what it takes in this fiscal year's note? I'm trying to understand how we got to the math in a little bit more of a easier system so people at home can understand this. I think that's what's important, that when businesses look at this, how did we get there? How many weeks will they have off? These are other questions I've got coming. So if you can help me pull that the algebra together. Weeks off, average weeks off. I know everything's averaged. Mm-hmm. Do the best you can.
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Chair and Lead Baker. So I think a couple things. So the FMLA data is one data source in this model, and I think the modeling approach here is more than algebra. It's multivariate regression as far as I'm aware. But I think one of the really key assumptions that goes into the model, and I think this hopefully gets to your question around, what's sort of driving some of the assumptions here. It's that table on the top of page 11 in the fiscal note, the model asks the estimated uptake rates for each type of leave. And we sourced this, I think, probably from the best comparable program you could find, which is actually the actuarial analysis from the state of Washington, their PFML program, which has been up and running for a few years now. So essentially, we're assuming similar usage rates to the state of Washington, which has a very similar program. That's one of the kind of key drivers in the model. Additionally, I'll note the FMLA survey also does include employers not covered by the FMLA. Again, it's one of kind of several data sets that's used in terms of modeling out what kind of the individual behavior would be like. Sorry, Mr. Chair. One last point to the author's kind of belt and suspenders point previously. I think we do have the actuarial, the legislation, the recently amended legislation does require the actuarial analysis to be completed by October 31st, so that there will be a checkpoint here as well.
Baker.
Thank you. And I guess maybe what we're trying to get into is, I know Washington has numbers, and I see they're averaging about 850 a week. They have so many weeks on average users of the leave time. But let's understand the average income of a program user. Is that a more generic number? What are you attaching to an average user? We have 204,000 beneficiaries that likely will use the program according to your fiscal note, about 205,000 people. What is your average per person? Is that baked in somewhere here so that we get an average somewhere?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Lead Baker. So I'll note a couple of things. One, I think, and right below that, right below the table on page 11, I will note that the values in this fiscal note, I think we view, are kind of doubly conservative. I think in terms of the total number of estimated beneficiaries, we used both the upper confidence interval that was provided as an output from the modeling. Additionally. There's likely some double counting of leave types here, in that in the sense that since it does it sort of on an individualized basis, it's likely that somebody may be eligible to take both ill child and ill spouse leave as an example, but they wouldn't be needing to take both concurrently. So I think in comparison with other states and those sort of other items, we think that the total estimated beneficiaries and benefits do provide you with a conservative estimate. In terms of the question just around the assumptions around what dollar values we're assuming. One of the inputs also is we would use the state's average weekly wage as sort of the kind of baseline for the financial impact overall as it's sort of modeling out that impact, right? It's using the state average should naturally get you to the place where you're going to find the most accurate value.
Lead Baker.
So I think what we're trying to also get to is, and I've heard you use that word, we're being very conservative with this. Does that mean you're being really on the high end of the worst case scenario when you say conservative?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Lead Baker, yes, that's the meaning of that's the intended meaning of conservative in this case.
Good.
Lead Baker.
And I think what I'm trying to get to and what businesses want to know, if this goes forward, and in other states we've been able to calculate kind of an average weekly leave in Washington and other states, average weekly output, and that's, again, when you're in the insurance business like you will be, you're going to have to figure out what is the average weekly cost to the beneficiary when they're gone. And so what we want to know as employers is roughly, if we offer 12 weeks, are we going to see 7 weeks, 9 weeks? On average, is there a way you can help us with that? Because that's an important number for employers to understand what the estimate is.
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Lead Baker, I appreciate the question, and that number isn't in the fiscal note. I think there may be ways to there are certainly ways to calculate it. I think one place where we'll get to that is with the actuarial study, to be sure. I think the other place to look is in the examples of other states. I think Washington State is a really is a good example of a program that's existed for a few years that has many terms that are very similar to ours. From memory, right? The actual leave-taking behavior in the state of Washington, even if one is eligible for 12, that's certainly not the average number of weeks that somebody takes based on the type of claim. And my sense is that it does vary quite a bit based on the type of claim. For example, qualifying exigency leave when you're working, when you're taking leave to help prepare a family member for a deployment to a foreign location. Those tend to be much shorter types of leave than, say, a bonding leave would be.
Pete Baker.
So I think we're having a hard time getting that number from you, or I'm trying to get to that so we can understand if this plan is solvent or not. And I know we've got an actuary, plan ahead. Let me ask you this, and again, I know you're not an expert insurance guy, I don't think, but are there concerns about this current plan that Deed has with laying out this income at a 0.7%? We know our income. We think we know what the numbers output are going to be. Do you say that this is solvent at this point before we know what the actuaries are going to say? Because I want to know from Deed, you think the numbers are baked pretty well, and if everything goes as according to plan in this scenario, we should have plenty of reserves, we should be in good shape, we shouldn't have to worry about an increase in our payroll tax. Is that what you're saying here today?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Lead Baker, yeah, just in terms of the question around the premium, I think you asked a question at the beginning of the question around premium rates, I think what you're getting to is, are the resources currently contemplated in this legislation sufficient to deliver the program as provided for in the legislation? I think page 12 of the fiscal note has the table around anticipated collections at the 0.7% premium rate that's contemplated in the legislation. When you look at that, and when you look at the summary tables and the projected expenditures for the program, the resources would be sufficient to meet that. So, I think yes, and we're confident that we can get this program up and running.
Lead Baker,
Mr. Chair, I think, and this is a good segue for me to maybe switch over to a Commerce question. I'm wondering if Mr. Kelly could come down from Commerce to maybe answer a couple questions.
Welcome to committee. Just identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair, or morning, Chair and members. I'm John Kelly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Commerce Department.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Kelly, for coming up. A couple questions for the Commerce. You folks every day look at actuaries, reports. Is it stable? Is it solid? Is it sustainable? And in your first look at this in the overview, have you had a chance to look at the overall plan here in commerce in your world, and is this a plan with it being kind of brand new? What would you give it sort of, you know, do you think it looks solid, well-built? You know, you have to, you look at this more than others. I'm just curious your take on it from the Commerce Department.
Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Lead Baker. So the Commerce Department has been working closely with DEED throughout this process. We are included in the bill. We were added to the bill in Commerce Committee earlier this week, where we are going to be in consultation with the DEED commissioner on the private plan options. We are ensuring that there is a surety bond if there is self-insured work, self-insured plans for PFML. We are, you know, and then also, while we have not looked at, you know, or performed the actuarial analysis here, you know, we supported the actuarial analysis being added to the bill. We have also, along with DEED and other agencies, been talking to our counterparts in other states where they have these programs. The language that has the Commerce Commissioner in consultation with the DEED Commissioner came out of conversations with Massachusetts and other states. And we also have been in conversations with the insurance industry. And so I, you know, this is a DEED-run program. I'm not going to speak for DEED or give them a sliding scale score, but I will say that we think that DEED has put a tremendous amount of work into this fiscal note. The bill author and other legislators have been working on this. We have confidence that not only that this program could be gotten up and running with what's in the governor's recommendation, but also that there will be an actuarial study to come in behind that on those numbers. So not an exact answer to your question, but...
Well, and Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'm almost done with my stuff, and I think we'll pass it along so people don't get sick of hearing me all the time. But my question is, too, you've got a piece of the pie here. You've been looking at some of it. There is an actuary study coming. Would you prefer that that study be known before we pass this bill?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Lead Baker, I think that Commerce supports the bill as drafted and up and headed in the committee here.
Lead Baker.
Okay, and my final question is, what if we fall short? What if the plan doesn't hit our projected reserves, our revenues fall shorter than our payouts? What is the backstop for Minnesota in this when you come for a commerce thing and a stability thing? How will we pay for the shortfalls?
Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Lead Baker, for your question. I believe that is a question better answered by DEED. Our portion of the PFML bill is around the private option, and the private option language that was added in Commerce includes review by our forms and filings team in the Insurance Division of Commerce to make sure that that is solvent, and those plans are good to go when they come in. And also, we had the surety bond requirement added to ensure that if employers are choosing the self-insured option, which is covered under this bill, that they have enough money to pay claims.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Did you want Mr. Rowe to respond to, or are you good?
You know, Mr. Rowe could actually ask that when he's probably going to come back down. I'm done with my questioning for now, Mr. Chair.
All right.
But that maybe will come back later. I'm assuming he might come back. Thank you.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson. You know, I appreciate this bill. Many ways that I could speak of. I just want to say that in terms of the value that it brings to both employers and employees, I think it's a strong contribution to our economic and social well-being. My questions are related to the fiscal note also, and we may have exhausted the one around the conservatism of the assumptions as outlined on page 11. But I would ask Commissioner Rowe if there were just a couple of things. One, I want to highlight that as a data analyst and data modeler, I appreciate going conservative. I have found that the only way to avoid some big problems down the road. So that's one of my questions is, you are not rosy around estimated beneficiaries and benefits, which is great. Are there other places where you would look at your assumptions that are baked into here, whether it's the simulator, the Worker Plus tool, or other assumptions that you've made in here that still leave more risk than we might want to have? Or is it pretty as tough as it really could get?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ryer, I would say that the two, again, there are two primary sources of conservatism here, right? One is the use of the, when you get the output from a model like this, you get a lower confidence interval, you get the midpoint, and you get the upper CI, mm-hmm. and the upper CI, I believe, is at least the top quartile possible, so I think using that consistently is definitely leads to a more careful set of outputs. And again, I would just say by summing all the types of leave across the board, right, you get down to about 204, the number provided in the fiscal note is 204,000. From memory, in Washington State, a state that has a third, again, the population of our state, they don't have that many. In the most recent year of data, they didn't have that many beneficiaries across the state. So I think, I maybe should have worn suspenders with my belt today, but I do think that this is a prudent and kind of sober-headed analysis.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. To me, that's one of the most important messages of the hearing today and the review of the fiscal note, because the risks that Representative Baker is presenting in terms of being insolvent, putting us at risk, would be greatly magnified and not acceptable if we were down at a lower confidence level or even a medium one. And I think that for me, it's very encouraging and gives me even more confidence, not just in the values of the project, but the sustainability of it and its ability to not do harm while we're doing good. The other question I have, and this you may or may not have any comment on this, Commissioner. This may be more for the bill author or someone else. One of the facts of life is that if someone is out on their own personal health leave because they're so ill, they're ill anyway. There's absenteeism. There's cost there. There's instability to companies. Otherwise, people are coming to work sick, and that's not good either. So it's not like they're going on leave or they're at work. So I'm interested to know if there's been any research on the impact on absenteeism or the impact on retention in states where there is a plan in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Ryer, for the question. And yes, there is definitely research around retaining workers in the labor force when there is access to paid family and medical leave. And some of the most extensive work has been done around bonding leaves. And we know that one of the contributing factors to folks not returning back to work after giving birth is related to a number of challenges that are sustained. Babies have to be 6 weeks old before they can go into, a formal childcare setting, and that creates real challenges. And so there is definite benefits related to retaining folks in the labor market, and specifically on the gender side, women, and keeping them connected. And it seemed
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I would just close my section of questions then by saying that we live in a reality that we have workforce shortages. We're looking for opportunities, all kinds of opportunities. We've spent the first part of the session being really creative and collaborative on how we can build our workforce. And to me, this is a really practical and valuable workforce contribution. So thank you.
I have Representative Harder, Zalesnikar, and then Brand. Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Zhang. Representative Richardson, the questions that I have to go around the solvency of the plan. So if I understand correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, there's a certain amount that you plan to have in for reserve. Do we know that that would be the amount going forward? Do we have any idea what amount would need to be in that reserve starting, and what would that amount be going forward? Where would you like to keep the plan at?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Harder, for the question. So as we're looking at the fiscal note, what we are looking at is 0.7% model would generate about $1.5 billion in revenue each year. And because we're also this bill would also start with a $1.7 billion benefit as well to shore up the program, we definitely have the sustainability piece in mind. This work, as the commissioner has talked through, the modeling that we've used from the U.S. Department of Labor, that is a tool that we will be able to continue to use if there are shifts that would occur as well.
Representative Harder.
Thank you. I guess another question, please. If the claims, because we don't know exactly how many people will be taking this benefit, so if the claims exceed the funds that are available, what is the plan when or if that happens?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. So according to the fiscal note, I think DEED is estimating that approximately about $1 billion annually would be paid out in claims. You know, thinking about sort of the breakdown, 80% of these benefits would be for a worker's own serious health condition, a pregnancy, or bonding. And I think it's just important to lift up the conversation that just the exchange that just happened between Representative Ryer and the commissioner as well, related to the conservative approach that has been taken. And again, just bringing members' attentions to page 11 of the fiscal note, it reads that the values in this model and output are doubly conservative. And so this, I think it goes past worst-case scenario in terms of thinking about that, the approach that is being taken here. So I think the idea is being proactive around this, and we have an opportunity with this bill to learn from what other states have done as well. And so the approach that is being taken here is to be extra conservative.
Representative Harder.
That's all. Thank you.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill. I understand. I think we all want to see something happen. And, you know, my questions that I wanted to ask, if you could walk me through the eligibility determination part of this and how it would be applied.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, are you asking about eligibility under the definition of serious health condition?
Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. Yes.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to qualify for this program under a serious health condition, it will require a consultation with a doctor, which is a process that exist right now in terms of as it relates to what we currently have as FMLA leave. With that, the employee would be working directly with DEED because they would be administering the program. So they would submit the information that would determine whether they would be qualified for a leave.
Representative Lestikar.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Can you walk me through the eligibility for the family side?
Sure, Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think what you're referring to is for bonding leave if someone is giving birth.
Representative Lestikar.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Richardson, my question is more on the broader question on the other pieces, caring for another family member.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the process would look similar in terms of the serious health condition, because in order to qualify for leave, the individual would have to either have their own serious health condition or they would be requesting leave to care for another family member. And so that would require, again, consultation with a doctor and submission of that information for consideration to the program administrators.
Representative Lestikar.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative. And I'm trying to understand, and I think that's what my question is, the definition of serious health. And how DEED will the department will determine that eligibility process, and then that approval process, how that will be communicated back to the employer.
Sure, Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, in terms of the way that the process works now for leave, I think there are a lot of things that are similar in terms of thinking about this as the program would be administered by DEED. The bill does deal with sort of when there are like known conditions that are occurring versus when there's something that would happen unexpected. But the idea is that when someone puts in for leave, it would go through an approval process where it could be denied, it could be approved, and based upon that decision would determine sort of what the next steps would be. But ensuring that there are components in here that would ensure that employers would know that an individual is qualifying for leave.
Representative Lestikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. Can you walk me through what the process looks like in your estimation for the application determination? That is, the department has made a determination on approval. And what information then is communicated to the employer, and how is that going to look? Can you help me understand that, please?
So, and I mean, so if the question is related to is private health information going to be exchanged between DEED and the employer, thinking about the data, that's sort of a separate question. But what would be communicated to the employer would be that someone would be eligible for leave.
Representative Lestikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. So my question now is then, after listening to that response, walk me through the procedures of how this is going to look if the employer has information that potentially contradicts the department's determination. Is there an appeal process for the employer, like you would have in unemployment? Can you walk me through what that looks like for the employer?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, there would be an appeal process.
Representative Zelastikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. So can you walk me through what that process looks like?
Chair Richardson.
The employer could submit an appeal, and there would be a hearing. based upon that appeal, and then there would be a determination that would be made. And if the employer disagrees with the determination that is made, they can go to the Court of Appeals. Everyone gets one Court of Appeals free.
Representative Zuzdikar.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson.
Representative Brand.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Richardson, I just wanted to build a little bit upon what Representative Ryer was talking about. She had mentioned some comments about absenteeism I think were foundational when we're talking about other states. And I think some of the conversation also has to be addressed with, you know, we're talking about medical. Sometimes medical can mean, you know, got to go to the doctor and have a surgery or something like that. You know, it's a statistic in this country, 1 in 2 people get cancer. That's a big statistic. That's going to hit a lot of people that have cancer. But also, there's a lot of folks that have other challenges in life, including mental health episodes. Those don't resolve themselves overnight. And sometimes people with mental health episodes just are not going to be the best employees at work. Does that mean they have to get fired? Does that mean they have to quit their jobs in order to get the help that they need? No. And I think that this will actually kind of help shield some of these folks from having to go through that situation. We're talking about people who maybe end up with substance abuse problems because they are not able to get the help that they need. There are also some folks that end up getting into homelessness situations because they're not able to get the help that they need. And some of that is tied to employment because it's hard to have a house, hard to have an apartment if you don't have actual employment wages coming in. And so these are challenges that we also have to grapple. This is what I like to call quality of life issues for folks in Minnesota. And I really don't think that it matters where your zip code is. These are challenges that everybody in Minnesota, a lot of Minnesota families will face. I wanted to also say, too, I think some of that is tied in with crime as well. And so I think that we're looking at other states, we're looking at other states' data. I really do think that our state is positioned well to have a well-thought-out product. I want to thank DEED. I want to thank Department of Commerce for putting together with you a product that I think we can all be proud of in Minnesota that's actually going to help our constituents. It's actually going to help our families. It's actually going to help people who need this when they need it. This isn't a get-rich-quick scheme. This is for people who need it when they need it, a safety net. And I think that that's really important to hit home. The last thing I just wanted to point out, as a person with a small business myself, I feel like, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on putting people into a pipeline to fill these jobs. There's over 200,000 jobs available here in Minnesota right now. But maybe not enough emphasis is put on entrepreneurship. I'm thinking of all the garage businesses that started out in garages and ended up being very large companies, very successful companies. If we don't provide those garage businesses with some sort of a support to try something new, to maybe give more emphasis on people actually trying something new and maybe even failing. Look at Thomas Edison. How many times did he fail before he invented the light bulb? We need to have more ability, I think, for people in Minnesota and across the country to try something new and different. And I think that this helps get us to the point where we have people who are feeling more likely to try entrepreneurial options in their lives. And so I do like this bill. The one thing that I would like to talk to you more about and work with you a little bit more on is this idea of wage offsets for the very, very small businesses. I'm not talking about businesses that have 50 employees. I think that's too big of a scope. But let's talk about the people that maybe have 20 employees or less or some combination of that. I know that they're working on something similar to that in the Senate. I would just like to have another conversation with you about that. Thank you.
Representative Senator Mira.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Zhang. Thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill and for all of your work on this bill. I think that it's really appropriate that this is the last bill I think that this committee will hear, fingers crossed. you know, and I think something we've heard about again and again in this committee is our workforce shortage problems and this kind of idea that, like, we need everyone, right? We need all the workers we can get. And I think we've focused on this committee a lot at how do we bring more people into the workforce. And I think we've done a lot of work about, you know, supporting nonprofits to do that or thinking about policies that do that. But I think we also need to think about once people get into the workforce, how do we keep them there? And I see this bill as really helping to think about the retention piece, right? Because I think right now what I hear about from constituents all the time is this real frustration that it feels like our state and in our country more broadly is asking you, like, you can either be a caretaker or you can be a worker. You can be a mom or you can be a worker. You can be a human that gets cancer, that has a mental health issue, or you can be a worker, but you can't do both. And I think both because it's a moral and the right thing, but also because I really think what we're seeing is that our economy needs it. Like, we have to allow people to do both. And I just want to speak a little bit, you know, to my experience regarding paid family leave as both, you know, an employer and as an employee that got to have that benefit. So before I came to the legislature, I was an executive director at a nonprofit. We were small. We had six people. And when I came in, we didn't have any kind of paid family leave policy or paid medical leave policy. And, you know, I knew for myself and for the other people that I worked with that a lot of us were reaching an age or reaching a place in our life where we were going to need to start thinking about that policy. And it was really hard. I mean, like, nonprofits don't have a large profit margin. That's the whole point of them, right? So it's not a business that has a lot of extra money. And I knew from experience how much money and how much quality of our programming and quality of our output we lost when we had to let people go and then not have those positions for a period of time and then work to, you know, retrain someone else. Like, there's a financial loss to that piece. And so, you know, we worked to put in a policy. What we could afford was not 12 weeks, but I think this would have been huge for us, right? This would have been huge to help with the financial piece of this. I also really like that there's a support for small businesses. I like, you know, the idea that Representative Brand talked about, like, this will be hard for small businesses. I don't think anyone is not saying that. Like, this will be hard. But I think we have to figure out a way to make it work. And I say that because of my experience as someone who took the leave, right? And so I had a kid 5 weeks early. He was in the NICU. And I would go to the NICU and spend time with him, and I would notice that other parents did not have that opportunity. And I remember a nurse said to me, oh, you're a good mom compared to other, you know, other people that weren't there. And I realized I wasn't a good mom. I just worked for a company that had a paid leave policy, right? And, like, if there is anything that can make you see, like, we are not on the right balance of, like, being a caretaker, being a human versus worker, it's seeing NICU beds where people can't, no one in the family can afford or has the option to sit with that kid. I mean, that there's just something like that image, you feel like something is wrong, with really deeply wrong with our system. And so thank you for working to fix that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Next is Representative Nelson.
I'll pass.
Lead Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I just want to say thanks to the members. I do have one final question for Mr. Rowe. I'm trying to get back to maybe a little bit of the fiscal question I'm getting to was the average. What is the average assumed income of this program per user? And what is the average weekly payment from that program? What I heard was in the Senate version when I was listening to that tape is you had an average weekly income that you were expecting. And I'm wondering if that's still a number that you're sort of revolving around. So it helps me with the math to see what it was the model, what it is now. So thank you for that.
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Lead Baker. So just to clarify, so when in terms of when you run the model, essentially, you're trying to, I believe that one of the inputs for the model is what is the average wage that you are assuming that somebody is, will take within the state. So for that, for that input, we naturally use the state's average wage, right? So that's what then kind of flows through the model and flows through the outputs and gets you to the beneficiary and gets you to those levels in the beneficiaries. Does that help?
Well, and Mr. Chair, we're getting there. That's what we're trying to get to. I mean, again, you made a statement in the Senate, $850 a week. You know, just recently you had made that statement. I think that it was in the last Senate hearing is the average weekly payment would be about $850 a week. Again, we've got our floor at $200 a week, and we got our max at $1,300. So again, it's on the tape. It's an average. It's whatever. Nobody's holding, but that's an average, and those are the kind of numbers I'm getting towards for folks that understand where this is at. And I think the reason so many of us want to just dive in and ask all these unique questions is we love the idea of providing this benefit. This is 80%+, as Representative Richard said, we want this in Minnesota. But it's how we can find a way to get there without trying to put everybody in the same size box. Representative Brand, thank you for bringing up an idea, or maybe you want to talk more to the author about recognizing small business. I have beat my head against the wall to try to understand how we can get something in here for a small business operator. I hope that results in some good outcomes. We are here to help you work on this. I think that because we are on the hook, folks, we have to get this right. So, you know, going through the fiscal note today and having a lot of these questions still not quite answered, and I know we just got an updated fiscal note this morning with the university system kind of jumping on, I'm still not convinced we have an insurance program that is ready to go before an actuary is going to give us a report in October. I would hope that the majority might want to say, look, we want to get this right. We want to maybe pause this. I know it's going to taxes. I know we're going to vote it out of this committee today, Mr. Chair, and I guess I will ask for roll call before we wrap this up.
Roll call has been requested.
But I want to make sure that it's the idea of let's make sure we have a sustainable program that has the ability to recognize differences in businesses. We need to recognize the timing of this IT project, which is going to be a massive project to integrate DHS and other agencies into a system that DEED will, I think, hire another third party to do this. My experience with Minlars was so bad that I have such a bad taste in my mouth. It was a challenge, and I think they're taking some better steps to not let it go that way. But we also had problems with vendors that didn't do what they said they were going to do. So we are beholden sometimes to an outside vendor that you're going to really rely on to get it right as well. And I know this has been a tremendous amount of work for everybody to get to a offering in Minnesota that we all want to find a place to get there to. So, again, we have more questions about what if people are taking advantage of the system and how are we going to recognize that. Even one of the agencies here, Met Council, has said, look, we expect 15% of our frontline employees are going to take advantage of this program. 15%. I thought that was honest. I think it was accurate. I think that that's a big number. Imagine 15%, and those employees are like every one of else's employees. We're all going to be looking at 15% of our staff is going to use some sort of leave and other things on top of the paid time we already have given or the sick time that they've already accumulated and the other benefits that we've got in our handbook. So this is all important, and I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation. Again, I've got serious concerns about the stability, the sustainability, the solvency, but we will continue to work on this because we still have to find ways of finding ways to approach the smallest business and how we can recognize those and also still let employees be a part of this. So, again, members, I say we're not ready yet. I hope that we hold off on this a little bit. And I think the actuary numbers are what's really critical to this and how we approach it from there. So with that, members, I really appreciate a no vote today.
Briefly, closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think it's important to let the record reflect that we do recognize small businesses within this bill, which is why there are grants that are in the bill for small businesses. And as I said previously, happy to continue to work with individuals if there are other ideas on ways that we can also support small businesses. But I also think that it's important that we have a bill that recognizes people's humanity as well. And I think it's important that we recognize that we need a bill that would not eliminate people from having the ability to care for themselves or to care for their loved ones based upon factors that are related to what type of employer they work for, what their zip code is, what they look like, or who they love. So I think we need to be able to do both of those things. We can recognize and support small business, and we can recognize and support people's overall humanity as well. I also just want to lift up the fact that there are financial costs to not doing this bill. And because the chair asked me to be brief, I will not go point by point related to those financial costs. But there are costs related to turnover. There's loss to our economy, and there's human loss, as well as we think about rates of infant mortality and maternal mortality, and the costs related to ICU stays that are oftentimes related to preterm birth as well. So thank you for the robust conversation. I'm sure it will continue. Appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. The clerk will take the roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Roll call voting on HF2 will now commence.
Yeah, I renew my motion to House File 2 be re-referred to the Taxes Committee. Now, clerk will take the roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Starting with Chair Zhang.
Aye.
Vice Chair Brand.
Aye.
Lead Baker.
No.
Representative Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Yes.
Representative Harder.
No.
Representative Hemising Yeager.
Aye.
Representative Ryer.
Aye.
Representative Sensimura.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Weens. Representative Zalesnikar.
No.
Mr. Chair, I report to you we have 7 ayes and 5 nays.
No vote, 7 ayes and 5 nays. The motion prevails. House File 2 is on its way to the Taxes Committee. Members, we don't have any hearing scheduled yet, but do watch your emails in case if we do have another hearing. They'll be at the call of chair. Seeing nothing else on the agenda, the committee is adjourned.